FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome, and you are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and today is May 22nd, 2018. Well, free trade, is it all it's cranked up to be? Are the benefits innumerable? Does this rising tide of international trade truly lift all boats, or perhaps sink some and only raise others? All good questions. First, though, as always, we urge you to be part of the show, to join us on the journey. Nothing is more satisfying than seeing your emails in the morning in my inbox when I wake up. Email address kl@kerrylutz.com, or you can just go to the site and click contact. Either way, it will get to me. Anyway, so more about international trade. Is it really so-called free trade all it's cranked up to be? Jeff Ferry is with us. Jeff, you're research director at the Coalition for a Prosperous America, and welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Kerry. It's good to be here. How are you today?
All is well, thank goodness. So when we look at what's happened with trade, you wrote a recent article about going back to the economist Ricardo, who first postulated that basically what's good for free trade or good for global trade is good for everybody. And it seems to be that you're espousing a view that that there are consequences and there are winners and losers. And for decades, the U.S. economy has been the big loser here.
That's right. I think that the view that free trade is good for all nations and the lower the tariffs and the more the trade, everybody will benefit. I think that view applied between 1945 and roughly 1975 pretty accurately because the world economy was in an unusual place. And I think for the last 40 years, we've seen that that hasn't really applied and things have got worse, particularly after 2000. And I think now it's pretty clear that when you've got a country like the United States running a huge trade deficit year after year, 42 consecutive years, trade can be bad for us. And trade, where a lot of other countries are cheating, are basically violating the rules of free trade and subsidizing their own industries to seize large parts of the markets for manufactured goods, and these are important industries for us and for other countries, that puts us at a disadvantage. So instead of being win-win, it can be win-lose in many cases, and that's what we've experienced, particularly for the last 20 years.
So one interesting area where I'd say free trade to some extent exists is in certain commodities. Now, free trade ain't what it used to be. Let's put it that way. But if you look what's happening now with U.S. production of petroleum, natural gas, and the burgeoning export markets for it, do you think that free trade has worked there?
Yeah, I think that free trade is good for us now that we're changing from a structural importer of petroleum and related products. We're roughly in balance right now, and I think that we're going to be an exporter in the next few years. And that's good for our petroleum industry, and it's good for consumers of petroleum in this country, too. So, you know, I'm not saying that free trade is always bad or always good. I'm saying it depends on the circumstance. And, you know, petroleum, you know, having a boom in the oil industry is good for the petroleum industry and for the suppliers to that industry, which include a lot of manufactured products. But manufacturing as a whole in this country has seen its employment fall by some 25% since the year 2000. And in general, manufacturing pays good wages, it's good industries, it's their growth industries, and it's that decline that has hit the U.S. economy pretty hard, and particularly in areas in the Midwest and the South, really in New England as well, in the Western states, all over, we've got regions that have traditionally been dependent on manufacturing, and for them to lose those industries has been a severe blow.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on the other hand, though, some of the decline in manufacturing employment, Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, is due to continued automation, AI, artificial intelligence, all of these things, robotization. That's really gutted a lot of manufacturing that is left in the U.S., hasn't it?
I would say you've got to put that in perspective, and I don't really follow that school of thought, and particularly when you use the word gutted. An industry, automation shouldn't gut an industry. Automation should make an industry more productive and more profitable and more successful. So if you said to me what's happened in automotive, I would say, yes, there's been a significant amount of automation which has reduced the labor force you need in a car factory to produce a given number of automobiles. But if you look at something like textiles, furniture, toys, all kinds of metal products, those industries have been gutted because of trade, not because of automation. I mean, yes, they're more automated than they were 20 years ago, and some economists use these figures to produce misleading results. They're more automated because the only companies that have been able to survive are more automated. But I think if you look at the manufacturing statistics as a whole, the Department of Commerce divides manufacturing into 19 sectors. 14 of those sectors have a lower output today than they did in the year 2000. So that's three quarters of the sectors are seeing less production and less output. And the number one reason for that is trade. I mean, here's another way to look at it. Manufacturing, after the Second World War, employed about 20 million people. Every decade, we lost a million people from manufacturing, and that was due to automation, because automation's been going on, as you know, for something like 200 years. Mm-hmm. And automation takes people out while increasing production. So you're losing 5% of the workforce every decade. That's very reasonable, and the economy can accommodate that, and that's generating more wealth and income for the people left in the industry. So that's 5% every 10 years. In the year 2000, in the subsequent 10 years, we lost 30% of our manufacturing force. Now, you can't explain that by automation. You can't say there was some revolution in automation that happened between 2000 and 2010. What actually happened was what economists are increasingly referring to as the China shock, which is that China came on stream into world trade in a massive way, using subsidies and other strategies, an artificially low currency that enabled it to seize a large market share in the U.S. of U.S. products, and our imports shot up, and thousands. I think the number often quoted is 60,000 manufacturing establishments closed between 2000 and 2010.
Yeah, so it's an interesting phenomena, and it's not just taking place here in the United States, happening all over the Eurozone, not so much in Asia because labor costs are so low there, and they have their own set of trade barriers to keep out the cheap Chinese goods and to favor developing domestic industries in places like Thailand and Vietnam and Malaysia. And you look at probably the third most developed economy, or fourth in Asia, would be South Korea, and they had their host of tariff, non-tariff barriers for U.S. goods and everyone else's as well. And now, thanks to Trump, those have been largely diluted and minimized.
Well, I think your basic point is right, that we shouldn't just look at China, that many countries, particularly Asian countries, but also Germany, have been running their economies in a form that I call export-led growth, which is to favor exports as a way to grow the economy and also to hold spending down and to increase saving and divert those savings into investment and into exports. Now, what you have to understand, though, about many of the other countries in the Eurozone, is they've had economic problems outside of Germany, particularly the southern periphery from Portugal all the way across to Greece. All those countries have had problems. But Europe as a whole has been much more circumspect in allowing Asian imports into the European region. And that has limited to some extent the dislocation and the disruption that has been felt. So, you know, China's surplus with the United States last year was $375 billion. their surplus with the entire world was about, I think the number's about $480 billion. So in other words, something like 75% of their surplus is accounted for by just U.S. trade. And the reason for that is we have an almost religious belief in free trade. So we've let the Chinese, we've allowed them to take enormous sectors of our industry and sell goods. You know, steel is just one example where we're the only major industrial country in the world that imports more than 20% of its steel. Other countries have ways and means which don't involve tariffs usually, but involve other means to restrict the amount of steel imports. So China said back in 2000 timeframe, they want to be the world's number one steel maker, and they're going to have their government subsidize investment on a huge scale. And that produced a huge oversupply of steel around the world. And most of that steel has found its way into the United States. Even if it's indirect, even if it's coming from Canada, let's say, the imports we get, Canada is exporting to the United States because they're getting steel from China. So it's a complicated situation, but it's one where I think a neo-religious belief in free trade has not served this country well.
For sure. So what about the negotiations going on in China now? Looks like maybe a little progress has been made. What's your thoughts?
Actually, I'm very disappointed by what's happened over the last 24 hours because everything was going in the heading in the right direction. Until then, I think that President Trump did the right thing by putting together a team of negotiators and going there and saying, look, we need China to stop its huge surplus with us. We need China to take action to stop intellectual property theft. And the goal of saying, let's cut the trade surplus by $200 billion, this is the bilateral surplus that they hold with us, was a reasonable goal. What we've seen in the last 24 hours, Secretary of the Treasury Mnuchin announcing that we've reached some sort of agreement, we're not going to levy any tariffs, and we think things are going well with China. And from what I'm hearing, this is a bit of a climb down and a bit, you know, the president, as you know, the White House has been divided between two camps. You could call them trade hardliners, and I Right. consider myself part of that camp, and globalists. And both teams are represented in that team that's in Beijing right now. And it seems like the president, at least for the moment, is siding with the globalists. And I think that's a dangerous route to go down.
Yeah, well, one thing you know from President Trump is things are never quite as they appear to be. There could be a lot more going on behind the scenes, and probably is. And obviously we're not privy to it. And also with Trump, you know, it ain't over till it's over, right?
Right. That's absolutely true. And I don't want to say I'm making a firm judgment and saying that things are going badly. What I'm saying is I'm concerned because the noises coming out of Beijing and Washington and the White House over the last 24 hours are not as strong and as united as they were all of last week.
Agreed.
So you're right. There could be more to come down the pike, but it's important that the president hangs tough.
Yeah, of course. So, yeah, we'll just have to see what happens because all of these agreements. And I talked with your associate last week, and NAFTA. He seems to think they're going to stick with it for a little while and then eventually trash it. What's your take on it?
You mean we're going to walk out of the NAFTA agreement?
Yeah.
That's definitely a possibility. I guess I'm a bit more of a negotiator type of guy by instinct, and I tend to think that the team negotiating NAFTA, which is, as far as I can see, highly unified, are going to extract a better deal out of Mexico and Canada. And that's going to help our automotive industry, which is the main concern, or there are many concerns in NAFTA, but that's one of the important ones, is to get some stronger rules of origin content, which allow more American content to be required for an item to be considered a NAFTA product.
Absolutely. And they've been playing this scam here. You know it. I know it for years. The Canadians and Mexicans becoming backdoor transship points for Chinese auto parts. Basically, that's all they've become. So when you look at this and you say, yeah, you know, there's definitely more here than meets the eye as well. And the U.S. has a lot more leverage over this group of trading partners, perhaps, than over China, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we are 80% of the GDP of the three countries in NAFTA, and they all want to sell in the United States. And their governments don't have the same control over their own population that the Chinese government does. So,
yes, exactly.
We are in a stronger position.
Exactly. So you optimistic as far as an accommodation being achieved for NAFTA?
Yes, I would say on balance, I'm optimistic that the administration gets a deal on NAFTA. You know, I don't know when, you know, there was some talk about getting it this month in order to have Congress vote on it this year. It may be that that deal happens in the summer and gets voted on early next year by Congress. Mm-hmm. But I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll get a deal and it'll be a good deal for American industry.
It will really. The Canadians and the Mexicans, they need us a heck of a lot more than we need them. But you don't really want to just economically abuse your neighbors. You want to come up with a fair and equitable means of managing the trading relationship, right?
Right. I agree. And I think it's not, you know, when I say it can be win-lose, I mean, that's true, but that doesn't mean that you can't find a way to negotiate a solution which in the long run benefits everybody. So mm-hmm. both of those countries benefit from a stronger, more robust, faster growing U.S. economy. If we can get there, then we'll end up buying more Canadian goods and more Mexican goods in the long run. So it's a good thing. When I say win-lose, what I mean is you don't want all of our jobs and all of our major industries to leave and go to Mexico, because that leaves our economy poorer if all that happens quickly and simply because of cost differentials.
And it'll wind up cutting the demand for Mexican products. So they don't really win.
Right, absolutely.
But trade isn't just a zero-sum game where you win, I lose, I win, you lose, right? It's more than that, isn't it?
Right. It's not a zero sum game. And you know, at times when politicians talk that way, it's a little bit of hyperbole. But you have to see trade in the context of economic growth. I mean, trade is there to help us grow our economy and grow the living standards of the workers and of everybody, you know, of everybody up and down the wage scale, and including the companies that own businesses and that make a profit. We want profits to grow as well. And where trade can be good if you are investing in growth industries and growing, both through selling domestically and selling on export. And trade can be bad if it is hollowing out your industry, making it impossible for your industry to make money, and you haven't found other growth industries. And, you know, people talk about we have growth industries, as, you know, California's got Hollywood and it's got software up in Silicon Valley. But, you know, you've got to have broadly based growth industries. It's not enough just to have a Google or a Disney. They're great companies, but, you know, they employ a small number of people in the larger scheme of things.
Exactly.
So that's why you've got to favor the industries that can benefit the nation as a whole.
For sure. So, Jeff, we want to find out more about you, more about your organization and all that you do. Where's the best place to go here?
Yes, absolutely. Go to our website. It's called prosperousamerica.org. We are a coalition. We're pretty unusual in Washington in that we unite manufacturers, labor unions, farmers, and ranchers, and we're bipartisan. We've got Democrats and Republicans in our organization, and we're all focused on improving the trade deficit and improving U.S. trading relationships as a way to help rebuild manufacturing, rebuild the agricultural sector, and raise U.S. living standards to get us back on the sort of growth path that those of us who are older can remember from the 1960s and that sort of era when the U.S. had a lot of growth industries. So that's what we're all about. And at prosperousamerica.org, you can read about our organization. You can join up. You can read the articles I write. I'm an economist. I'm the research director. And we've got many other interesting board members who write some interesting stuff, which you can find on our website.
All right. Sounds really great. We appreciate you coming on the show. And always great to have you on. As I said before, any questions or comments, anything else, email me at kl@carrielutz.com, Twitter feed at Carrie Lutz, and the Facebook page is Financial Survival Network. Please visit the site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Sign up for our free newsletter. Got one going out tomorrow. Jeff, always great to have you on, and keep writing. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Thanks, Carrie. Great to talk to you. Take care.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.